This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world. Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Wednesday, 5th of April, 2023. A pretty interesting shift in sentiment yesterday, the proximate cause being the February U.S. JOLTS job openings survey, which came in far weaker than expected, just below that 10 million figure versus 10.5 expected. And the prior, the January number was revised down several hundred thousand. That seemed to be the proximate cause, certainly timing-wise. If you look at where the big reaction was in the Treasury market, we'll get to that. But Peter, you're also mentioning, as you put in a headline there on slide two in today's slide deck, that it was Jamie Dimon's comments, perhaps, on the banking crisis at the J.P. Morgan's annual shareholder meeting that could have spooked sentiment here. And the overall interesting thing being, as I'm sure we'll discuss, that we have a fresh and pretty chunky decline in yields here. But that's not seeing the market celebrate. It's actually rolled over sentiment wise, and that's maybe an interesting change of tone here.
Yeah, to be absolutely or 100% correct, it was the annual shareholder letter which he always sends out before you get to the annual general meeting, etc. But the point is that he spent considerable time in that letter to talk about the ongoing banking crisis, and he was very tough. And we've mentioned that on this podcast as well. This irony that regulation post the Great Financial Crisis really overemphasized government securities, you know, very low risk weighting. I mean, I had a comment on this podcast as well that, you know, these are the Basel III pillar rules, and it really works well, but it really assumes, you know, a linear relationship on risk in all scenarios, which we have seen with SVB that it's not really the case. I mean, if you have an interest rate shock, then you have considerable unrealized losses in these securities. And then at the same time, if there's pressure on your funding side for whatever reason, then you can get into trouble. So then suddenly they're not as safe as you assumed on the capital requirement. So, and he basically, I think, was really the phrase mimicking what we also talked on this podcast recently, I think a couple of days ago, the CEO of Julius Baer out of Switzerland, which is now the second largest financial institution after UBS and Credit Suisse were merged, said that, you know, the banking crisis will continue for years. I mean, there are structural issues at banks. And Jamie Dimon basically highlighted that. And I think that combined with the JOLTS job openings, which if you take a 12-month change in that time series and you strip out the data points during the pandemic, we actually have the weakest job openings change since 2007-08, before we went into the recession back then. And you saw it, and you can see that on slide two. If you look at the industry group's performance, the four worst performers were materials. That's where chemicals and mining companies are sitting, and then semiconductors, energy, and capital goods being, I think, probably the biggest of that industry group with the highest beta to the economic cycle, because it's really tied to capital expenditures and investments. So I think, John, the market yesterday priced, you know, a higher probability of recession, also because the U.S. 10-year yield made a new low on the close for the cycle.
Yeah, and that's an important point. And apropos that U.S. 10-year benchmark, slide three, I have that on the upper right there. So there's an intraday low that was slightly lower and just ahead of the nominal and psychological 3.25% level. I think that's going to be quite an indication if we're closing below that level for a further breakdown in yields strength in the Treasury market. But I just a little bit specific to the JOLTS survey there. I put on the left there that survey in black with that's the filled line below that. And you can see that the non-farm payrolls change, at least in the past two cycles, past two major cycles, the pandemic was so abnormal, I didn't include that, that these were sort of properly changing direction before that JOLTS survey. So again, it just felt a little bit like the market was grasping for excuses. And the important thing being, if this is what the market is super sensitive to, we have a lot of other data points coming up in the next week. And really in the next days, we have the ISM services up today. I'll preview all this on the macro calendar, but a number of other employment-related gauges, the ADP private payrolls is up today as well. But look how quickly the market is also marking down the Fed once again. Lower right there on that slide three as well, I have that world interest rate probability section of the table from Bloomberg. And you can see we've got slightly lower odds of the next 25 basis point move, but more aggressive on the projection and expectations beginning priced in of Fed cuts. Look at the December FOMC meeting there, 13th of December, 2023, marked at a rate of 4.2%. So well below, more than two rate cuts below where we are now. So the market is really thinking that this recession is coming hard and fast and sufficiently going to impress the Fed that it'll be cutting rates in Q3. Speaking of central banks, we had an interesting development overnight with the RBNZ surprising the market and me, especially because I was thinking they might be looking to sort of bring in the guidance to a more optionality in the future, a pivot to sort of maybe we'll continue, maybe we won't. Instead, we got a 50 basis point rate hike from the RBNZ above the market's expectations and very out of sync with what we're seeing elsewhere. The Bank of England wanting to clearly move to a pause, Bank of Canada being the first to actually explicitly pause, the RBA also pausing this week, although the RBA's Governor Lowe was out saying that you shouldn't read this pause as necessarily meaning we're going to start cutting rates. There was a little bit of backtracking on that. But the RBNZ's move and its focus on saying that inflation is simply too high, that hawkish message, certainly getting some respect in the market. We saw the New Zealand dollar marked sharply stronger. And look at the contrast there on Aussie Kiwi, or reaction function there on Aussie Kiwi, down below 106 and at a local low there. We have been slightly lower back in December of last year, but that contrast is just really remarkable between the RBA and the RBNZ. And as our macro strategist in Asia, Charo, said, you get the sense that the RBA is just hoping it can just do enough to sort of tamp down on inflation and slow the economy without triggering a recession. Whereas the RBNZ, you almost get the sense that this is a recession by design, that they understand that you need a recession if you're to get the inflation demons slain here. So interesting contrast. Again, lots of action to Aussie Kiwi. If we are headed towards an economic slowdown and a global slowdown sooner rather than later, that will mean the RBNZ will have more backtracking to do relative to the RBA. So at some point, that could mean revert. Elsewhere in FX, do note the dollar is still weak there. Again, as I've said before, if we're getting a rollover in risk sentiment, I think that starts to provide some support for the US dollar. Whereas the rates side of things is not necessarily dollar positive, but the risk side becomes more important. And then on the speaking of rates, we saw a much firmer Japanese yen yesterday. That makes a lot of sense when you see, of course, lower rates. But the combination of lower rates and if we start to have weaker economic data as seen as bad for sentiment, bad for the outlook, that would be doubly supportive for the yen. So I'll look for that potential for a pivot. And sterling, a real head scratcher as a leader among G10 currencies. Certainly, if we're about to pivot and find some resistance for global equities here. Also note that gold breaking above $2,000, closing above that $2,000 level for the first time since in over a year, and that prior close above that level, I think it only lasted a single day before dipping back below. So very technically a critical development there in gold. All right, let's see. Where should we pick up things here, Peter? You've got some thoughts on European utilities. It's a really hot topic because, especially in our Q2 outlook, talking about the fragmentation game and talking about the scale of build out needed if we're to make this energy transformation from fossil fuels to electrification. I mean, it's everything from electrifying your source of home heating. I have one here, a sort of an what do you call it? A heat pump, which is basically an upside down air conditioning for those of you not familiar with them. You're cooling, or sorry, you're heating your home by sucking the heat out of the air outside. And yeah, so where are we with this? And of course, the electrification of the vehicle and transportation fleet as well.
Yeah, so we did a piece on this because, and we called it a flashy headline, called it the second age of electrification, because the first age was basically from 1880 till the end of the Roaring Twenties, which was a 50-year-old long period with a rapid expansion in electricity production and consumption by consumers, and then we went into a more stable growth environment for a few years to come. And now we seem to be on the cusp of the next arc, if you will, of electrification, because what happened was that the fossil fuel, gasoline, etc., took over and dominated after the pandemic, sorry, after the Great Depression, with the avalanche of cars and later airplanes, global trade with ships, etc. And that was based on very energy intensive carbon. And now we're trying to reverse that that very long period with fossil fuels being dominant in both in heating, but it's certainly in transportation. And one of the things that are interesting is that when you read through the different forecasts for electricity consumption, there's a very wide range of forecasts. So McKinsey, I highlight that, they only have a 40% increase in electricity consumption by 2050 in Europe. I mean, I don't know. They assume a pretty hefty energy efficiency gains per year of 2% all the way to 2050. Might be true. And Bloomberg's New Energy Finance has a forecast of, I think, 80%, 60 to 80%. But then I found this, and I think this is more to the point. I found this Danish survey. It was done by the utility sector here in Denmark, in collaboration with the government. And the reason why I don't get the McKinsey figures is that if you just take a simple household, then it's consuming in Europe roughly on average around 3,700 kilowatt hours per year. So that's 3.7 megawatts. And a normal and on average heat pump, as you described, John, consumes around 4 megawatt. So that's a doubling of your electricity
Can I
consumption right
stop you
there.
there for 1 second? Because looking at my household with a heat pump, and I don't have a small house, I have kids and everything, and plus one electric vehicle. And it's winter, of course, so the heating is far higher in the winter, and this is not be averaged out over a year. But you said there was a 3,700 kilowatt hour. Was that the figure you said for a household for a
That
year?
that's the estimated average household consumption in the EU across all the 29 countries.
Okay, sure. So in some households could just be a small apartment, etc. But ours
Yes.
for a single month during the winter is on the order of 1,500. So it's a
Yeah.
very electric. If sort of my household is the electrified future, which it basically is with the heat pump and the single electric vehicle, then it's going to be far above that, of course. So sorry, I
Yeah,
just
yeah.
wanted to just put
No,
that in. I
it
actually had that figure at hand because I recently looked at my electricity bill.
Yeah, but I think it's a crucial point, because that's why I don't. My point actually in my analysis, it was quite long, and I hope you will read it. It will sit at the top over the Easter break. Is that I think a lot of the forecasts, they underestimate the impact and the magnitude of what will happen. So you have the heat pumps, we just mentioned that. We have the electric vehicles. So the U.S. Energy Department estimates that one electric vehicle roughly requires 3.7 to 4 megawatt hours per year in power generation for and that can be better over time, but that's the current number. So if we take the 3.7 average electricity consumption for an EU household, you add a heat pump and you add an electric vehicle, then you up 2x, right? Sorry, 3 yeah 3x. So you go from 1 unit to 3 units of electricity. And then in this Danish survey I found, you also have the power to X technologies, which are coming alone in Denmark. They expect until 2030 that will add 10 terawatt of this whole power to X technology, which you have to think about. Denmark is using 35 terawatts of electricity right now, so 10 already there, and then 7 from data centers. And I think that's also one of the things that I missed in some of these forecasts, is that our digitalization of everything from entertainment, what have you, is just driving an extraordinary demand on electricity from these data centers. And we talked about it on the podcast, and you and I the other day, John, and you have this weird situation with Nammo, one of Europe's largest ammunition manufacturers in Norway. They want to expand capacity because there's a huge growth opportunity, but they can't, because the electricity for now in that region where they operate is reserved for TikTok, because they're building a massive data center. So there are just all these things point to a massive growth opportunity. And I think some estimates out there are saying, $5 to $6 trillion of investment opportunities over the coming decades. So read the article. We flag all the companies, utility companies, and electric equipment manufacturers in Europe. And I think it's an interesting industry. It's very robust, and some of these companies have very high operating margin. And my final point, actually, and I think maybe you'll appreciate it, I've put in this little graphic that's from the Bloomberg's New Energy Finance, and you can see all. And that's also the thing. I don't know whether there's a lobbying going on in Europe But I find it very strange that all these forecasts are so damn sure that nuclear will not play a role at all, a very minimal role, and that wind, and in particular offshore wind, will drive the dominant transition. And I think that is a little bit of a conundrum, because if you look at what has actually happened over the past couple of years, it's actually solar that is by far outpacing wind. So something doesn't really stack up there, and I have an idea that solar will be the thing that makes the difference and not wind. So again, I think these long-term forecasts, take it a little bit with a grain of salt. And I don't know whether I'm good at predicting the future. I just find it odd that you'll be so certain about wind.
Yeah, I can hear a special edition podcast somewhere out there in the future on all these topics, because it's really fascinating. And that whole power to X argument is, to my mind, I don't see how they can invest in it. It's the green hydrogen and the conversion inefficiencies of doing that, and how do you store hydrogen, et cetera. So it was so interesting. And also, if you do solar and or wind, the energy storage around that, some of that storage could come from all the whole battery fleet. The whole cars themselves being a sort of a fleet of storage, potentially, but you also need some stationary storage in there. Anyway, let's move on, Peter. This is a daily podcast, and also adding to your electrification argument, there's the whole AI thing, and we're going to talk about AI in a special edition podcast as well. That's a very electricity intensive, because of the number crunching for it. But back to today. Today is Wednesday, April 5th. What are the stocks you're watching today?
So one of them is so I don't know how to pronounce it actually. I think it's a French company. Sodexo. It's a very large fertility services company. They do a lot of things, but it's all related to the services sector. But they have almost 500,000 employees. They are with a result for the first half that ended in February. Very strong results here. They ain't even lifting the organic revenue growth rate to 11% from previously 8 to 10. So those share prices up 7%. I put in the Saxo chart here on slide 6. So it's a little bit of a misprint with that very odd bars. I don't pay too much attention to that, but I'll just say that Sodexo is a very broad indicator on the services economy, and apparently that's doing very well in Europe, despite, as I said in our internal call, the euro coin growth indicator, which is the real-time GDP indicator in Europe, actually slipped lower into negative territory in March. So a little bit of divergence there, maybe. And then cloud stocks. So the UK's Ofcom, which is the communications regulator, is out saying this morning that it has finalized a study showing that there are significant anti-competitive behavior in the cloud industry, making it very difficult for customers to switch provider or even use multiple providers. So they're now recommending that the market regulator in the UK should investigate this with a broader study. So obviously the cloud stocks, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, and maybe potentially Snowflake will be in focus today, because I mean, if they have these findings in the UK, you'll be quite sure they have the same findings in the broader EU, and then absolutely in the US. And one thing we didn't mention in the stocks to watch today, off the comments of Diamond, you should continue to focus on the banks. I just saw that yesterday there were some notes out that they're one of the most heavily shorted banking stocks right now of a certain size is actually Dominion Bank out of Toronto, the Dominion Bank out of Canada. So there is this focus on.
Traditionally Canada's largest bank, and they have a massive held to maturity portfolio, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly, and exposure to real estate as well. We should keep in mind as well, haven't talked so much about it in the recent days because of the momentum in equity, so that always sort of calms things out here or makes things more calm. But the real estate and the financials are intertwined and will have a weird feedback loop. And the real estate markets in especially Sweden and Canada, I think, are really at the forefront of what to expect. And if we see major cracks, we'll see it in Canada and Sweden first. I don't have too much to add actually on slide 7. We talked about Conagra Brands yesterday. It will be reporting at 11:30 GMT, so that's before the US markets are open or will open. And we just basically highlighted very quickly, very solid revenue growth, solid margins. It's one of those companies that are really able to grow at least with inflation and maybe a little bit above inflation. So one of those staples that investors really like to couple up when you have inflation. Very, very strong performance so far.
Yeah, and we were looking at their brands, including the pickle brands, and I complained about pickles yesterday, and Mr. Turayev was giving me some recommendations on what I could do about it on Twitter. So I appreciate the hat tip for where to get a good sour pickle here in Denmark. Moving swiftly along, two things. Again, about the incoming data, interesting to see that sensitivity, of course, to the JOLTS survey. So are we going to see this type of reaction function to the other stuff coming in here? And of course, especially if it surprises. So we get that ADP private payrolls change today, together with the ISM services, and it's up quite early. The ADP, as you see on slide 8, 1215 GMT, 1400 GMT for the ISM services, and then the weekly claims data as well has been so consistent. We saw it tick above 200K only once in the recent many weeks, if I recall correctly. There's been no consistent pattern there. And then with markets closed, I was getting all flustered. I can't imagine that they have markets closed and still putting out this official data, but that is the case, and it has been the case before. So yes, we will see a Friday release for the BLS data, the non-farm payrolls change, and then the household survey for the unemployment rate, et cetera. Average hourly earnings. Look for all of that on Friday. So that's an interesting mix. And then the key one, the other key one, will be the next Wednesday CPI release, of course, for March. So we have to keep up with what's going on the inflation front as well as the labor market front. All right, it's been a long one. Do also stay tuned. Tomorrow or today, we'll be recording it, hopefully, a special edition podcast on generative AI. Really excited about that. It's going to be a conversation with me, with Peter, you and myself, Peter. And we're hoping to have it as a part one with a part two to follow. We don't want to overpromise on part two, but we're going to position it as part one. We're hoping to get an industry expert in for an interview with for part two. But stay tuned for that. We'll drop that one tomorrow because tomorrow is a holiday here in Denmark, but not most of the rest of the world. And then we'll be back otherwise with the dailies from Tuesday next week. So until then, stay careful out there, and we'll be back soon with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.